abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody, on this Thursday, October 17th, 2013. Tom Woods here with Lou Rockwell today. Going to be talking to Lou in just a minute, but I wanted to thank you guys for subscribing to this program on iTunes. We have had a tremendous showing on iTunes pretty much right out of the gate. We've been consistently in the top 20 in news and politics, and we've gotten as high as number 2, and I think we're just getting started. So I'm deeply grateful to you guys. The program airs for the first time every day at tomwoodsradio.com at noon Eastern, and you can hear the program for the first time then with a chat feature. And then after that, the program becomes available in our archive at tomwoodsradio.com and on iTunes. Also, this Saturday, October 19th, I will be speaking in Raleigh, North Carolina. Check out the details on that at nullifynow.com. But let's turn now to our friend Lou Rockwell, whom I have known for 20 years. Lou, of course, runs lourockwell.com, which is the most heavily trafficked libertarian website in the world. He is also the founder and chairman of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Mises.org is the website. Mises.org is a tremendous website. And he is a former chief of staff to Ron Paul. Lou Rockwell, thanks for being with me here today.
Well, Tom, it's so great to be with you. And I feel like I'm maybe holding a rocket that's about to take off because, of course, I've noticed, and I must say I'm not surprised, how fast your podcast has climbed to the top of iTunes. And first you did so well with your guest shots on Schiff. Now you've got your own show. I've always thought, at least in the old days, I thought, well, Tom deserves to be up there with Savage and Limbaugh and Levin and all the guys we hate and don't listen to, at least in my case, don't listen to, with a broadcast show. But maybe that's just old-fashioned. Maybe it's really serious that you belong on, where you would have the Tom Wood Show and be able to beat these guys. So I think there's only bright things ahead for you in terms of this medium. And so, you know, it's great to be on the show.
Well, thanks, Lou. That's very generous. Over the years, I've had ups and downs, and, you know, things that I consider ups, the New York Times considered to be downs. And all throughout, you know, you were by my side and defending me and supporting me when everybody else was running away and treating me as if I were radioactive. And then now, all of a sudden, everybody wants to be my friend. But back then, not a lot of people wanted to be my friend, but you did, and I never forgot that, and I certainly appreciate it. So,
well, I'm just going to praise my own prescience that when I first met you as an undergraduate, I knew you were a star. I knew you were going places. I knew you were going to be somebody significant, and so none of this surprises me.
Well, thanks, Lou. I appreciate that. I want to talk a little bit about some of the, I mean, maybe this is going to be kind of like a stroll down memory lane a little bit, because you've known a lot of significant people in the movement. I mean, Leonard Reed and obviously Ron Paul, even Ludwig von Mises to an extent, and of course Murray Rothbard. And these are all people who are of great interest to listeners.
Well, and rightly so.
So let's start off with that. First of all, let's stroll down memory lane. How did you first enter into this, you know, the sort of the libertarian movement? Who were the people you got to know right at the outset?
Well, you know, I guess if we sort of can think of the pre-libertarian movement, I would credit my dad. He was a strong Taft Republican. And in fact, my first political memory is of during Taft's campaign against Eisenhower for the Republican nomination in 1953. I remember my dad pinning a Taft for President button on my coat. So I sort of was inculcated early on. I don't know if I would call my dad a libertarian, but he definitely was a non-interventionist in foreign policy. and a free market person, and he was a surgeon, and even in medical care issues, as far as in those days it was illegal, for example, to be a chiropractor in Massachusetts. So all the chiropractors practiced right along the border of New Hampshire or Connecticut on the Massachusetts border. And he was an advocate of chiropractors being able to practice, of midwives being able to deliver babies without going through gynecologists and so forth. So I would credit he, and it's really he and some of his good friends who were responsible for giving me the books that I would say led me to have similar ideas. And I was sort of notorious in school, but I can remember in the seventh grade, long before the Civil Rights Act of 64 was passed, my history teacher advocating that sort of a law. And I can remember arguing with him, and I didn't have logical arguments at that point, but I just remember saying, it just seems to me wrong. If somebody owns a business, why can't they be in charge of who comes in and who doesn't? I mean, I couldn't see why having the police make that decision was better than having the owner. So I guess from very early on, Ron Paul says that he thinks at least most of us are born libertarian, those of us who are libertarians, and that it's just a matter of discovering what are the various ramifications of our already existing orientation.
Well, it's interesting that so early you latched onto an issue that so many people who claim to be libertarians want to run a million miles away from, which is the subject of anti-discrimination law. But that really is the issue among libertarians, isn't it? It's the question of what is the role of the state in society? And anti-discrimination law claims that the state has the right to play all kinds of micro-level roles at all different levels of society, from employment to private socializing. And it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a bad person to say, no, I don't want violent means used to force people together who don't want to be together. And so one thing I really liked about Ron Paul, of course, is that he could have shut a million people up by just saying, you know, you're right, I favor anti-discrimination law, now let's just move on. It would have saved him so much grief. And yet he just said, no, it violates principles that go back to John Locke, and you can derive all my views of property and liberty from that, and it does not include the power of a state to do these sorts of things. And he just, and I think even though he said things that were unpopular, you know what, that in a paradoxical way contributed to his popularity.
Well, it's true, and I think the point that he makes that just because bad people might use freedom of speech is hardly a reason to abolish freedom of speech. And in fact, if we're interested in defending freedom of speech, then it is the so-called bad people whose rights we need to defend.
Well,
so
that's,
the
that's
same
true.
With property rights. Maybe we don't like what somebody's doing with their property rights, but as long as they're not offending against somebody else's rights, leave them alone, or maybe, as a matter of fact, defend them.
And of course, we extend basic customary legal protections to people who are bad or who are openly guilty. This doesn't mean we like these people. It means that these are the values of a civilized society. All right, so I want to fast forward a bit, though. I mean, how did you did know Leonard Reed for a time. Is that right?
I did know Leonard, and I had subscribed to the Freeman, like many people from all during high school. And when I went to work for Arlington House, run by the great Neil McCaffrey, great entrepreneur, just a great man in general. And this was the only publishing house in America at that time that would touch libertarian or conservative books. And it was the publisher of Mises, for example. And I'll never forget Neil McCaffrey calling me into his office and saying, would you like to be Ludwig von Mises's editor? You know, and here I was, a very young kid, and of course I was bowled over and thrilled, and so it was through that connection, and when I was first living in New York, that I got to meet Leonard in person. I'd known him through the Freeman before that, so because of my connection with Mises, I've spent a lot of time at the foundation, and I thought the world of Leonard Reed. He was a great leader, very charming, great-looking guy. Very well spoken, of course, and just a tremendous, very funny, full of jokes, and yet very profound. So he was a great man, and also he's responsible because he held a reception when Arlington House, the three books that I'd worked on, and also a new monograph of Mises' Omnipotent Government Theory and History and Bureaucracy, and also a monograph on the historical setting of the Austrian school, which was new. And in fact, just as a slight aside, I'll never forget opening the brown envelope and taking out this new manuscript from Mises. I mean, just, you know, obviously a tremendous, tremendous thing. So Leonard held this reception in honor of these three books. And at the old Fee Mansion in Irvington on Hudson, now sadly gone, Fee no longer has that. But they had a dining room. And so I had a tray from the kitchen. I walked into the dining room. And the only people sitting there were Ludwig and Margaret von Mises.
Oh, gosh.
And so I thought, do I dare go over there? And I said, well, of course, I have to go over there. So that's the one time I met Mises. I talked to him on the phone. And I spent a lot of time on the phone with Margaret then and subsequently and in person with Margaret. But that was the only time I ever met him. And it was, of course, one of the great experiences of my life.
Now,
but that was Leonard who made that possible. And then later I find out, just several years ago from Ron Paul, that the thing that made Ron offer me his job of chief of staff was that Leonard had called him and recommended me.
Yeah, I heard about that. That's a real compliment. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I realized just now while we were talking, Lou, that sometimes we're in such an inside baseball world that we forget there are young people who may not know who Leonard Reed is or what Fee is. So we're talking about the Foundation for Economic Education, which played such an important role in the early years, and Leonard Reed, who headed it for a long time, is just considered to be one of the sort of godfathers of the movement at large. But that sort of brings to mind, I'd like to know, and I think other people would like to know, how did you meet Murray Rothbard? I mean, this would be the sort of person somebody would love to know personally, and you had the chance to work with him so closely for so many years. How did it get started?
Well, you know, I will say that he was not only, of course, he was such a brilliant scholar and such an unbelievably productive scholar, such an important scholar in so many ways, but he was just a great guy. I mean, there's nobody on earth you would rather have a beer with. I mean, he was so funny, so interesting, so just, you just immediately loved him. And so I had first met him when Arlington House published his Conceived in Liberty series, not published by the Mises Institute, his History of Colonial America, which is quite wonderful, like all of his books. But I didn't really get to know him well until I started the Institute, and I approached him. Would he be in charge of our academic affairs? At this point, of course, it was only a letterhead organization. But I've never forgotten, he literally clapped his hands in glee at the idea of a Mises Institute.
Beautiful.
I mean, it just thrilled him. He thought, you know, and he was very generous with his help and his time and his advice and his example, I might say. So I got to work started the Institute. I talked to him every day. And in addition to everything else, he was like a stand-up comedian. I mean, you were never in Murray's presence, whether it was in person or on the phone, very long before you're laughing out loud. I mean, he was so funny and so humble, too. I mean, he's an example. Murray was not a Christian, but I always think it was an example of the Christian ideal of humility, which is not, you know, to be abasing yourself or, you know, some things that some other people might think. But that he didn't, you know, he really was open to everybody, interested in everybody, didn't matter what their status was. They had the slightest spark of ability. He had a bellows, and he was, you know, trying to fan the flames. He didn't. I think of Milton Friedman as kind of being the opposite of this. Milton was so arrogant and so nasty to anybody, say any student who asked a question he didn't approve of. I mean, just looked to crush people. Murray was nice to everybody and very open. He's glad to talk to anybody. He didn't put himself on a pedestal by any means, even though he could have put himself on a pedestal. So he was, and of course, so smart, he knew everything so far as I could tell. I mean, just,
yeah.
You know, I don't care whether we're talking about art or theology or, just as well as, of course, economics and history. And the
post-millennials and the pre-millennials? Like he knew that.
And he also thought that most economists neglected the importance of religion, for example, and he absolutely did not, because they weren't religious or they disliked religion, so they never wanted to consider its role in history, but obviously it's a key, it's a very key thing. So anyway, he was open to people who, didn't agree with him, but he didn't, he never was shy about stating his own position, but he could change his mind if somebody had an argument he respected. He loved to have people who were harder core than he was try to refute him.
Yeah.
But he was charming, sweet, fun. And I'll just tell one quick story that sort of sums up his abilities in a number of ways. He was rented Sidney Hook's house, of all people, at Stanford for the summer. He was working at Institute for Humane Studies when Baldy Harper was still running it in California. And so a friend is visiting him, and the friend said, so, Omar, I'm looking forward to seeing you at Cato next week. This was the Cato Monetary Conference before they kicked Murray out. And Murray said, that's not next week. It's, a month from now or whatever. And his friend said, no, it's next week. So Murray checks with Joey, who was sort of the realism principal in the household. And she said, no, it is next week. So Murray excused himself, went into the other room, and this is his paper on New Deal monetary policy, and typed out the paper in one fell swoop, including bibliography and footnotes. And so he had written the whole thing in his head.
Before. And that's a great paper. I've read it.
No, it's a great, of course.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was the, so that was the kind of ability that he had.
And, the thing about him, Lou, is that the reason we speak about him so fondly is that people who got to know him, and I only knew him a little bit, but I met him four or five times and talked to him on the phone and stuff like that, but we had a real affection for him. It wasn't that we worshipped him or any of the nonsense they say about us. And yet what's so funny is people say, you people worship Rothbard, and yet I actually have seen a guy, I'm not going to mention his name, but he's with a very well-known think tank. I've seen a picture of a guy posing with a photograph of Milton Friedman. Now, I've never posed with a photograph of Murray Rothbard. I mean, so they take the Friedman admiration to absurd lengths. And nobody denies that Milton Friedman was very articulate and a very skilled debater, and he had many merits.
Very smart.
No one disputes, yeah. Right? But why is it, then, that people can't give the equal share of respect to Rothbard? Like, why is Rothbard like the un-person? I think I said this on your podcast one time, for every 100 times they mention Milton Friedman, Rothbard gets mentioned once. But I would say it's more like for every 100 times we hear Friedman, it's 0 times we hear Rothbard. And you look at his corpus of work, and none of these people at these institutes in their entire lives are going to do 1/1,000th of that. Why does he not even get a fleeting reference?
Well, I think it has to do with the old paycheck question. Because for whatever reason, Charles Koch, and he's the only intellectually significant member of the Koch brothers. Charles Koch, for whatever reason, became a Rothbardian and then became a non-Rothbardian. And once he became a non-Rothbardian, anybody associated with him in his broad empire of so many organizations and so many people on the payroll, and of course an infinitely larger number of people who want to be on the payroll, they had to hate Rothbard. So I think it's as simple as that. I mean, maybe there's envy sometimes involved, or you can't look into people's hearts. I'm suspicious of that, but I can't know it. Just because everything seemed to them to come so easy to him, although he worked like a dog. I mean, he worked every day, all day long. When he wasn't sleeping or teaching, he was working. So I mean, that's part of Edison's line about, more perspiration than inspiration to be a genius. Well, Murray put out the perspiration. But I think it fundamentally comes down to the fact that if you want to be on the Koch payroll, if you want to be on the payroll of one of these many organizations and publications that are within the Koch ambit, you have to hate Rothbard. So that's, I'm afraid I think that's the reason rather than any intellectual rejection of Murray.
But that, I think, goes a long way toward explaining why in so-called official and respectable circles you don't see mention of Rothbard. But in the real libertarian heartland, let's say, you know, when you actually go to events around the country that are outside of D.C., everybody loves Rothbard. Everybody's wearing the Rothbard enemy of the state shirt. They're reading his books. They're learning from him. Everybody loves him.
Well, it's the great thing about one of the many great things about the Internet. There was a time when the fact that, I don't know, that at the Cato Institute, they hated Murray's guts, would have an influence on whether people, you know, would dare to cite him or read him or whatever. But now that there was a funny event when somebody, an anonymous guy, I think I know who he was, but writing for The Economist, and said, really, you know, what's wrong with the Ron Paul movement is that they pay attention to Rothbard. If only they would substitute Friedman, why, everything would be fine, which, of course, would be the Keynesian economist view, because Milton Friedman, by the way, was a Keynesian, among his other attributes. So I wrote a blog about, that outside of strictly academic circles, I thought Friedman was disappearing. I just didn't think that he had the influence among libertarians that he once did, and that Rothbard was vaulting ahead. So somebody on David Friedman's blog, who was upset at my comments, and I, of course, this is his dad. I mean, I can't be upset at him for being upset. Somebody said, you know, this is really unfair because Milton Friedman's books are all very expensive, and you have to buy them in hardback. It's unfair because the Mises Institute has put all of Rothbard's stuff for free on the Internet. So it's not fair competition.
What?
So I thought, oh, well, you know, okay. But, of course, here's what I was correct in one sense. Murray is so compelling. He's so interesting that they can't suppress him. And not only can they not suppress him, it doesn't sort of matter. To the extent they tell students, don't read this guy, why, of course, they immediately want to read him.
Right.
So he's a vastly bigger figure than he was during his lifetime. And I... You know, there was just a column the other day by Bruce Bartlett, who used to be an Austrian, writing for the New York Times, and he's writing about the whole idea of defaulting on the debt, the federal debt, which, of course, Murray advocated default. That's the only way to, quote unquote, to handle something of the size of the federal debt. You have to, you know, default on it because the people who contracted for it and benefited from it are not the ones who are being forced to pay it. So,
right.
From a matter of justice and many other reasons. So, but he quoted Murray in his article. So the paragraph from Murray, again, you know, just jumps off the page at you. I mean, it's so vivid and so interesting. And thank goodness Bruce, to give him credit, linked to Murray's article about the defaulting on the debt. So it's just another example of Murray never would have been quoted in an economics article on a new blog at the New York Times. Things are changing. Murray is a huge figure all over the world. His works are read everywhere, and he really is our most powerful engine in terms of interest in getting students and others interested. Obviously, he stood on the shoulders of Mises, and of course credited Mises for everything. But Murray, in terms of interesting kids, he's the guy. It's so thrilling, it's so moving to see him so broadly loved. And as you say, whether it's in the libertarian heartland, whether it's among students at colleges and universities, whether it's in the Ron Paul movement. I can remember you mentioning Rothbard at the Ron Paul Minnesota rally and getting cheered for mentioning Murray's name.
Yeah, yeah. That's a different world. It's a world that unfortunately...
world is different.
Right, and it's a world I only wish he could have lived to see. And of course, people who are listening to this, Lou, you had an article not too long ago, and it was simply called Read Rothbard. So if you're wondering, how do I jump in? The guy's written so much. What's my natural entry point? I would just Google Lou Rockwell and Read Rothbard and check out, because that's a pretty good program for reading. But I will just say, I don't want to keep piling on here on Friedman, because I'll get people will attack me. Woods, you know, he's got a vendetta. I don't like weird, cultish behavior. And this... cutting off Rothbard and favoring Friedman, when in all the areas where they differed, Rothbard is vastly better. from the point of view of scholarship and libertarianism, he's vastly better. But what I find, Lou, is not only that Rothbard is the more influential figure when you just talk to ordinary libertarians. Yeah, some of them will mention Friedman. I read Capitalism and Freedom, or I read Free to Choose, and you know, there's some good material in those books. But
yes,
very few
absolutely.
Of them are going to say, I read Friedman's article on methodology in 1953, or I read any of his technical stuff on monetarism. That's got almost no traction whatsoever among libertarians, whereas the actual theoretical economic work of Rothbard has got plenty. Now, given that we're running a little low on time, I do want to give you a chance to say a little something about the Mises Institute. I mean, we'll, some other time we'll talk about the travails of founding the Mises Institute and all the difficulty. You would think that'd be an easy thing, or it would have its difficulties starting from scratch, but you'd think everybody would be friends on this. You'd have a lot of allies in this, and the real story, I think, is quite interesting. But let's suppose the Mises Institute, I don't know, all of a sudden its budget doubled overnight. What would you do? Like, what is your ideal? What would you like to see the Mises Institute doing that you hope someday it can do but isn't doing today?
Well, I think that the Institute represents the future of higher education. I think that the bricks and mortar universities, with what the federal subsidies to higher ed have done to the cost of education, Ron Paul worked his way through college. That sounds like science fiction today. Nobody can work their way through college. So what they've done, just exactly with medical care, they've made it impossible for students. So the students have this horrendous debts, and the colleges and universities, by and large, are just either teaching error or they're teaching, you know, the official boring view of stuff. So I think that then, of course, boys are being taught that they're the scum of the earth and they're responsible for everything evil. And it's one of the reasons fewer and fewer boys are going to college. So there are many other reasons why Peter Klein points out that colleges and universities still have the same production model, but Aristotle did. A guy at the front of the room talking to a bunch of kids and sitting down.
Right.
So there are different ways to do it. I think the Mises Institute is at the cutting edge of those different ways. I think as young people are sick and tired of what these long 5 and 6 years terms at college, they make it so difficult to get all the courses you need. You end up with these horrendous debts that can never be paid off. But there's another way to do it, and we see with the you know, the online courses, and where companies are more and more considering certificates from these online courses to be as good as college credits. They take it very seriously. We've taken Professor Thurn's online course on robotics, which the first time he gave it, it had 160,000 students. That's when he quit his job as tenured full professorship at Stanford to go into alternative kinds of education. So I think there's all these guys at the regular universities, the elite schools are not going out of business. Maybe the big state universities aren't going out of business, but there are a lot of colleges and universities that are feeling the ground moving under their feet, and they're worried about the future, and they should be worried. So I think what I would like to do is turn the Mises Institute into this private online and campus based university of the future for Austrian economics, libertarianism, and history and political science and all related areas, where we'd give certificates. Can't give degrees because the whole government enterprise makes that impossible. But you can certainly give certificates, and as I say, business people are starting to take these certificates. Well, they do take these certificates maybe more seriously than credits from a college or university. So I'd like to keep up what the Institute is doing right now in terms of educating students, publishing books, publishing journals, bringing back the classics that have been unavailable for free, all that sort of thing. But I'd like to see us become really the Mises University for students all over the world who are interested in learning real economics, real history, and other subjects.
Well, Lou, that is a very exciting prospect that I hope to see come to pass. And I want to thank you not only for your time, but, of course, for your heroic work. And I've often said you're not only been a benefactor of mine in the past, but I think you're a benefactor of all those who want to pursue the truth in the world. You've made their job an awful lot easier. So thank you very much, Lou.
Tom, thanks for having me on the show.
All right, that's it for today, everybody. My thanks to Lou Rockwell. If you enjoyed this program, do me a favor and check out my labor of love, libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you. See you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.